So this is our Diwali. In fact, I looked on the internet today, and have you noticed on some of the sites trending? The hot topics that are flashing across the internet, they pick the top 10 things that are trending. So Diwali was about number 6, trending worldwide. So it's something that people are becoming more and more aware of. There was a hilarious segment of The Office. How many of you saw that? How many of you heard about it? It was hilarious, and it was quite well done about 2 or 3 years ago, which upgraded the general recognition of it. Literally, Diwali is a composite of 2 words. Wali means lights. Wali means rose. And Dia means lights. So when you shorten Dia or Deepa and you make it D, Wali, it means rose of lights. And it stems from the epic Ramayana. I don't think that there's any other epic in the history of the world which is more popular, more celebrated in architecture, in puppetry, in poetry, in literature, in song and dance than the epic story of Lord Ram. He's an avatar of Vishnu, an avatar of Krishna, and he appeared many, many tens of thousands of years ago in northern India. And his mission, Krishna says that whenever an avatar descends, he does so for the purpose of annihilating the miscreants and protecting the righteous. So there was a huge miscreant on the planet at that time. His name was Ravana. And he was harassing innocent, righteous, pious people all over the world. So the Lord descended with this express purpose of annihilating Ravana. But he descended as a prince in the Raghu dynasty in northern India and Ayodhya. And he was destined as the oldest son to be the next king. However, on the eve of his coronation, due to a palace intrigue, instead of being coronated, he was banished to the forest for 14 years. He was so loved by the citizenry that they were brokenhearted at his departure. And in the 14 years in the forest, he had many adventures. And the exile into the forest brought him into confrontation with Ravana. The end result of which was Ravana was killed, and Ram returns to the city in triumph exactly on the day 14 years after he left. Everyone was overjoyed, and they lit up the waterways, the streets, the windowsills. They lit up the whole city of Ayodhya with lights. So when Ram came back to Ayodhya, and according to the Ramayana, he returned to Ayodhya from southern India on a Pushpa Vimana. Vimana means airplane, Pushpa means flowers. So apparently he returned from what is now present-day Ceylon and Sri Lanka to northern India by flying on an airplane of flowers. So when he was circling Ayodhya International Airport, the whole city was lit up to welcome him back. And that's the origin of this Festival of Lights, this Festival of Diwali. Now, about a month ago, or 6 weeks ago, we celebrated the Festival of India, which was culminated in a fireworks display and the burning of Ravana, the burning of an effigy of Ravana. Some of you might have attended that. That was celebrating the victory of Ram over Ravana, and now this is celebrating the return of Ram to his ancestral city, Ayodhya. And both of them have fireworks as an essential component in the celebration. So as I mentioned, we'll have fireworks also later on. Now these are some of the lights, similar to the lights that are going to be ignited and will illumine the altar in about 50 minutes' time. Light is a very, very key symbol in our culture, Vedic culture of India. God is represented by light, and all bad things are represented by darkness. We're often asked whether we believe in evil. The answer is no. We don't believe in evil as a separate power from God. We don't believe of any devilish, satanic personality who would carve out an area of sovereignty in which God had no influence. Actually, we believe everything is God. Just like on a day when there's no clouds, the sunlight floods every nook and cranny. So similarly, God and light and goodness and righteousness are available to everyone. However, if you turn your back and you cast yourself into shadow, what can be done? What can be done? So evil is just removal from the light. Like an ember, as long as it's nestled in the fire, it retains qualities of light and heat. But we've seen embers that are ejected from the fire. You've sat by a fireside on a winter day and you've heard... So some of those embers, they're thrown far enough away from the fire and they sit in that distant place long enough that they cool and they lose their qualities of heat and light. So goodness and righteousness and God consciousness are freely available to everyone. However, if we distance ourselves from our source, our spiritual source, then we become overcome by darkness. Another example, if you always walk west, when I come back from India, we fly in a western direction. And that's like a 24-hour day. You get on the plane in Bombay, you're in the air for 16 or 18 hours, and it's light. Night never comes. If you were to keep moving west perpetually, darkness would never overcome you. Of course, it's not recommended for health reasons, but this is just an analogy. If you keep moving with the sun, darkness will ever overcome you. But when you stop, then darkness overcomes you. So we have two choices in life. We're either striving to get better, we're either following the light, or we're allowing ourselves to get worse. There's no such thing as staying the same. We're striving to get better, or we're allowing ourselves to get worse. I love this poem by William Blake, The Sunflower. Anybody know that poem? It's the shortest poem in English language, so you could very well recite it. Sunflower, O sunflower, weary of time, who countest the steps of the sun, seeking that sweet golden clime where the traveler's journey is done. In other words, there is a world of light over which the Supreme Spirit presides and from which we originally come. We have allowed ourselves to be overcome by darkness, by inactivity and indolence. And so festivities and gatherings like these, which celebrate the light, indicate our willingness to turn things around, to once again enter into the light, and to make progress back home, back to Godhead. These are some of the metaphysical themes of the Festival of Light. And in fact, when we put up the fireworks and light our lamps and float them on the lake, we are celebrating the victory of good over evil, or the victory of light over darkness. Even Paul, you may know the story of Paul. Paul would have been called, most of you who are religious people, if Paul were living today, you would call him an evil person. I have no doubt about that. You would call Paul evil incarnate. Because what he did was, he hunted down Christians and he pointed them out for the Romans, and the Romans would arrest them and crucify them. He delighted in that. And after he hunted down all the Christians in Jerusalem, they fled because their lives were in danger because of this guy Paul. And they went to the outlying cities, you see. And the closest city was Damascus. So Paul volunteered. Now we've pointed out, we've fingered and killed all the Christians in Jerusalem. Now I volunteer to go to Damascus and go to the Jewish temples, and I'll point them out to you and we'll take care of them there. Wouldn't you say that if you lived in that time as a contemporary, wouldn't you call him an evil person? Wouldn't you call him evil incarnate? And that's what he was doing on the way to Damascus. And yet in a second, when the light penetrated, his heart was deep and dark and pitch black. But the deepest darkness cannot stand against light. It cannot hold its position, what to speak of, encroach against light. As soon as light enters a dark room, the darkness dissipates. So as soon as the light entered his heart, he changed. He changed, or rather his real nature became revealed. So we don't actually call, you can call someone as evil, but it just means they're deeply, deeply forgetful of God. And so we're trying to remove some of those layers here through such festivals as this. These are some of the ways that lights are displayed throughout the Indian cities and towns. And here is the fireworks display for which Diwali is famous. Now, Diwali, as well as being the New Year, is also a time of thanksgiving. If you're living an agricultural, rural lifestyle, this would be the end of your agricultural year right now, because the harvest would have been taken in. You would feast and enjoy the bountiful results of the harvest, and you would be battening down your hatches for the winter. If you were a merchant, you would be closing your books about now and then thanking Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, for whatever prosperity the previous year had brought you, and praying to her for equal, if not better, prosperity in the next year. In fact, as the devotees will circumambulate the veranda just now, simultaneous to what we're doing here, you'll notice in a corner all kinds of squashes and gourds and melons. Those were some of the items that we picked from our garden anticipating the first frost. And the elevator shaft there is full of green peppers and eggplant and all kinds of things that we just picked. So we had our own kind of harvest here recently from about 3/4 of an acre that's under cultivation. So in a very, very practical, close-to-earth, sort of holistic sense, this is the New Year. And as people all over the world do in the New Year, they make wishes. They make resolutions. They resolve to do better and to be better in the future as well. And we'll have a huge feast. Actually, throughout the festivities, you can acquire the feast. Not only have we cooked about 5 or 6 tasty, tasty preparations in quantity, but many of our visitors and guests have brought things as well. So there should be a wonderful feast downstairs. Now, it's a time of thanking Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. If you saw the poster that we put up for Diwali, you might have looked twice, said, does she have 4 arms? And the answer is yes. Because she bestows, you see. With her 4 arms, she gives to the pious more than what they can accept with their 2 arms. And this is, in fact, the day that Lakshmi appeared. There was an ancient epic story where the Daivas and the Daityas made a truce, and they churned the ocean of milk, which skirts the perimeter of the universe, and many, many wonderful things came out of this ocean of milk. Their end result was to get amrita, an elixir which, when drinking, gives you a lifespan of tens of thousands of years. But in the course of churning it, many other things were produced as well. And one of the things or persons that was produced was Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. She emerged from the ocean, a lady of dazzling beauty, and all the demigods and all the demons were smitten with her beauty, and they immediately wanted her to choose each and every one of them as her consort. So they sort of, you know, they spruced themselves up and they accepted various, what they thought were attractive postures. And they're all hoping, like anything, that Lakshmi would choose them as her consort. But one person, one personality remained unaffected, aloof, transcendental. Because this one person did not need a mate to make him more complete. He is none other than Vishnu, the cause of all causes, the self-sufficient Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he is already self-sufficient and complete. So he's not going around looking to be made more complete by having a mate. He is self-sufficient and complete. And when Lakshmi saw by his demeanor that this person, in fact, has everything, is everything, that whether millions and millions of people sing his glories or deny to do so, it doesn't add to him on the one hand, nor does it take away from him on the other hand. He's perfect and complete. So she became attracted to that personality. She became attracted to that personality. And indeed, probably psychologically speaking, those mates, whether they be male or female, who are most self-sufficient, who are most complete in and of themselves, are probably the ones that make the best husbands and the best wives. They're the less needy, you see. But all of us have to have a complement in order to feel ourselves complete, because we are parts and we're not the whole. Whereas that from which we come does not need anything else to be annexed in order to achieve completeness. So Lakshmi appeared from the ocean of milk on this very day, thousands and thousands of years ago. And then she chose Lord Vishnu as her consort. And on the altar, you'll see that Rama and Sita, as well as Radha and Krishna, these are different expansions. The original divine couple are Radha and Krishna in the center of the altar. Krishna is the dark figure with the flute, and Radharani is to our right. And then when they expand, they become Rama and Sita. Krishna expands to become Rama, and Radha expands to become Sita. In another incarnation, Krishna expands to become Vishnu, and Radha expands to become Lakshmi. The nature of the Absolute Truth is that He can expand Himself in such a way that the expansion can be just as powerful as the original. If you have a candle and you light 10 other candles, then those candles are just as powerful as the original. So the Absolute Truth, one of the features of being all potent, is that you can expand yourself and the expansion can be just as powerful as you are. So those who are flanking the altar to Krishna there, they are called plenary expansions. We're expansions, but the reason that you're not on the altar and I'm not on the altar is that we're partial expansions. Whereas Rama and Chaitanya and Vishnu, they're plenary expansions. We are like little particles of sunshine compared to the sun globe. They are all like the sun globe themselves, having unlimited power. Is that all right? Just to get a little reaction from it, if I say, got it, okay, and you got it, then you say, got it, okay? Got it? Good. All right. I'll do that every once in a while just to check up on you. Is that okay? Now, this is Dhanvantara. He also emerged from the ocean, and he's carrying the pot. He's carrying the kalash. On the top of most temples in India, you have the motif of the kalash. This will be on the outside of the temple. You'll have the kalash. And the kalash is symbolic of long life and shakti and power and righteousness. And it stems from this incident where from the churning of the ocean of milk, Dhanvantari, the lord of health and long life, emerged carrying the kalash, the pot, and in the pot was the nectar. Now people often ask about the red dot. After the aarti, those of you who want to come up, our priest Prem will be glad to put the red dot on the center of your forehead. We get asked this question probably more than any other question. What is the significance of the red dot? Now, traditionally, there's two significant. 100 or so more years ago, if you are a married woman, you put a red dot on the center of your forehead. That way a single man would know not to hit on you. It was like a stop sign, you know, forget about it, bud, you know. And you didn't have to, like, risk getting a crook on your neck to see whether she had a ring on her left hand. It was like right there, right in, you know, out front so everyone could see it. So that was the tradition. Of course, that's become diluted nowadays, so all kinds of ladies, married, single. And downstairs, we do a landslide, I have to admit, as being a co-conspirator, we do a landslide business selling these little adhesive bindis, which are decorative, and you just stick them on and you can take them off again. Are you wearing a bindi there? Yeah, see? She's got a bindi on there. $2 per pack, by the way. It helps support the temple. You know, when in Rome. You know. But more generally, the red dot for children, for men, when you visit the temple, the Lord, when He descends, He's called lotus this, lotus eyes, lotus hair, lotus feet, lotus this, lotus that. Why lotus in reference to the Lord? Because the lotus grows within water, and yet it never gets wet. Even if you splash it, the lotus leaf and flower will be bone dry shortly thereafter. The leaves are covered with a filament of oil, and the drops just slough off. So it could be said of the lotus, it's in the water, but not of the water. Like Christ said, the trick of the art of living is to be in the world, but not of the world. So this is especially true for the Lord. When He descends from the spiritual world, He does so in His self-same spiritual body. So He's in the world, He walks among us, He's a historical personality. At the same time, He's the all-powerful Lord of both the material and the spiritual worlds. People say, well, could you make up your mind? Is He God or was He a historical personality? He's both. Who has more of a right to come here than the person that created it? Isn't it? You and I, we're sojourners. We're lessers. We're renters. But actually, God created everything. And when He decides, He'll destroy everything. So in the interim period, nobody has more right to walk here and there than the Creator. Example is given that in a corner of the room, there's nothing. You don't have to look. It's just an example. I'm just painting a picture with words, you know. But let's say a spider comes, and from its abdomen, it spins out the filaments of a web. And then after some time, it retracts those filaments and goes away. But in the meantime, between the act of creation and the act of winding it up, that spider can navigate the web pretty darn good because He made it. Others get snaggled, if that's a word, in it, but because He made it, He can walk with impunity here and there. So God creates, God annihilates, but He also has the ability to come here as He did 5,300 years ago as Lord Sri Krishna. So His feet, the deity, I don't know if you can see here exactly, you'd have to go up, but the bottom of the feet of the Lord are red, just like most lotus flowers are reddish in color. So the bottom of the feet of the Lord are red. So when you come to the temple and you want the priest to give you a blessing, he puts his anamika, this finger, in the red kumkum powder and places it on your forehead. That is symbolic of putting your head at the feet of the Lord. And it promotes an attitude of humility and service. What he may also do additionally is take that crown and put it on your head and say, Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Param Sarapa Santi Suryo Deviva Chaksur Atitam Yad Viprashvo Vipanyako Jagavamsam Te Vishnu Yad Paramam Param. He says that as all of us, when we go about our daily activities, on some level of consciousness or another, we're always aware of the sun above us in the sky. May you be blessed that however high you rise, whether you be the Prime Minister or the President or even Lord Brahma, the Creator of the universe, may you always be conscious that God is above you. And in fact, that you are accountable to Him and you are His representative. That's why the crown has a pair of feet on top of it. So that's the significance of the red dot. Got it? Good. We don't do it here so much. We've got a permanent ranguli here. But many, many people in homes and in temples, they make elaborate yantras or designs from different colored powders at the doorways of their homes. And it's a belief that demons and evil influences, they only know how to go in a straight line. They don't know how to negotiate curves and angles. So when you decorate your entranceways with these elaborate designs, it foils the demons. You might have known people very impulsive. They get an idea and they just have to go and do it. Ravana, for instance. Ravana was like that. Ravana, as he was lying dead, as he was dying with the arrows of Ram in him, he confessed. He said, I had two things I could have done. One is, I had the technology to make salt water sweet water. I knew how to do that by mantra. Imagine what a boon that would have been for human society. Tens of thousands of years ago, Ravana had imparted the mantra that you could take any salt water and make it sweet. We would not know any drought today. Wouldn't that have been a great boon for all of humanity? And he knew how to do that. But he didn't do it right away. He had another interest that pushed that to one side. And that was his interest in Ram's wife, Sita, who was none other than Lakshmi. So he said, I can make the salt water sweet, or I can go kidnap Ram's wife. Which one do you think he did? Well, we don't have that technology, so I guess he went and kidnapped Ram's wife. And in the course of that, he got killed. So we never did find out how to do that. So this is the whimsical, impulsive, lusty nature of the demonia. And so people make these elaborate designs at their doorways so that the evil influences can't get in, at least on that particular day. See there? A demon would come up to that and he'd just do a Stan Laurel, you know. What's that, Ollie? You see how this is Delhi, the Capitol building in Delhi, how everything's lit up and illuminated. And sweets. Sweets are very... One year, this was about 10 years ago, we were celebrating Diwali in this very building. And I had thought my wife was going to organize a crew to cook, you know, some entrees and some rice and stuff. And somehow or other, it never happened. I think I was off and I came back a day. And I said, honey, we didn't cook, you know. And she said, that's all right. Everyone's going to bring something. And she was right. Dozens and dozens of people brought something, but it was all sweets. It was all sweets. So people had a plate of rasgulla, gulab jamun, peda, sandeshma. We made about 100 people diabetics on that one day alone. So ever since then, we make sure we cook nice, nutritious entrees and all. And of course, the sweets will be there for dessert. Okay. So Diwali is now known all over the world. When Governor Huntsman was up in Salt Lake City, we used to observe Diwali every year in the governor's mansion. We did that for 5 years. And in fact, he used to boast that the governor's mansion in Utah had the longest standing Diwali celebration of any state in the Union. Now just about every state has a Diwali, but Utah was the first one to start. And the White House had only started a year before that. They have a big Diwali in the White House every year. And again, as I mentioned, if you came in just recently, I started off the talk by saying that I went on the internet and I noticed what's trending in the last couple of days. And Diwali is right up there as one of the about number six on what's trending at the present moment. The ladies dress up just because it's the holiday celebrating Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. So we have all kinds of ladies beautifully dressed up in saris and salwa kameez. So, here are some stories about Diwali. Of course, if you're a farmer, as I mentioned, it's a harvest time. It's a New Year's for you. When you bring in the harvest, you give thanks and you have a big feast. So, we'll have a big feast, which is served out ongoingly throughout the night. Okay, something about the birds and not worrying about them eating the grain. Okay. Oh yeah, this is a technique that's used when the harvest is ready and it's full and you want to keep the birds away. You light lights and you put certain aromas in them to discourage them also from eating. And then also you do have a special place where the birds and the animals can go and eat their fill also, because that's the responsibility of the cultivator. Thanksgiving. Now, the origin of the festival, as I mentioned, has to do with the epic Ramayana. Channel 4 was out here Thursday morning, and I told Brian Carlson, I said the Ramayana is the most popular epic in the world. And he said, you mean in Hinduism? And I just said, yeah, sure. But actually, it is the most popular epic in the world. There isn't any story that's more celebrated than Ramayana. And we're just becoming aware of it in America. It's being taught now at 3 or 4 courses at BYU. Janae Haas has been teaching it for at least 15 years at Utah Valley University. High school level are becoming aware. But in Asia, it's huge. The Ramayana is huge in Asia. In Angkor Wat, in Cambodia, the largest temple structure in the world, the relief carvings of the Ramayana are there. If you go to Thailand, which is a Buddhist country, the number one tourist attraction in Bangkok is the Golden Temple. There's a retaining wall, which is about 12 feet high, goes 5/8 of a mile around the Golden Temple in Thailand. And you can start, and there's the story of Ram, Lakshman, Bharat, and Shatrughna, and their birth. And in this way, you can follow the whole story around and through the killing of Ravana and then the return to Ram on the Diwali day to Ayodhya. So, in Nepal, Thailand, Indonesia, Burma, India, everywhere the Ramayana is ubiquitous through architecture and poetry and dance and drama. And the two classical Indian dramatic selections that you'll see later on in the pavilion, they also have as their theme subject matter from the Ramayana. I'll let Ankit and Sahana explain those to you. So I'll just let you, you're probably all intelligent people, fast readers. It tells about how Ram was exiled for 14 years in the forest. And then Ravana kidnapped Sita, and Ravana's kingdom was in Lanka. Most people believe it was in present-day Ceylon. And he kept Sita captive there. Ram, finally, Hanuman, Ram's devoted monkey servant, he leaped over the ocean and he searched Ravana's city and he found Sita there in the Ashoka Grove. He burned the city down before flying back and reporting to Ram. And then Ram, because he was an exile, he didn't have any of his retainers, he didn't have any of his ancestral army at his disposal. But what he did was he allied himself to the monkeys that were living in the forest there in Kishikinda. And the general of the monkeys was Sugriva. So they went to the shore and Ram told them, "You write my name on the rocks and throw the rocks in the ocean and the rocks will float." So they wrote the name Rama and they throw rocks and boulders and mountains and they floated and they made a bridge. And Ram and his monkey army crossed the ocean on this bridge 800 miles. It was a 10-day battle of Lanka. One by one, Ravana's generals and soldiers were killed. And then on the last day, Ram and Ravana face each other, face to face. And with a deadly, lethal dart, Ram penetrates the body of Ravana and brings him down. And he never did change the sweet water from the salt water. He never did do that. So then, here is the chariot you see on this picture here. This is the aerial chariot by which Ram was transported back to Ayodhya. Now, the whole reason that Ram was exiled was that so that the mother of Ram's brother, Bharat, wanted Bharat to be king in Ram's absence. So she thought, "I'll get Ram out of the way and then Bharat will be crowned king." But when Bharat heard what she'd done, he renounced her and he said that for the 14 years that Ram is in exile, not only will I not become king, but I will sit on the outskirts of the city. I will not wear any jewels or any royal coat. I will not wear any crown. I will wear deer skin. I will leave my hair uncut. I won't shave. I will live the life of an ascetic. If anyone has any questions they want to ask me about ruling, they want any decisions, I will do that. I will perform those functions on behalf or as a representative of Ram. But I will not live in the palace. I will not assume any of the privileges that the king would take. I will live as an ascetic, fasting and counting down the days. And he said finally that if Ram does not return, if Ram does not return exactly on the day that the 14 years are up, then I will cast my body into flames and commit suicide. So here in this picture you see Bharat himself welcoming Ram, and he said, "I will keep the shoes of Ram on my head at all times." So when Ram finally came back on the Diwali, Bharat took those shoes, he put them on Ram's feet, and he participated in the coronation ceremony. And no one was more happy to see Ram king than Bharat, for whom the whole conspiracy had been mounted. This is the classic picture. When we do our Ramayana at the Festival of India, after the drama is over, Rajiv and Gita, who play the role of Sita and Ram, and Anand, who plays Lakshman, and Jai Krishna, who's leading the kirtan down there, they assume this pose, and everybody comes up and gets their pictures. Anybody got your picture taken at the Festival of India with Sita, Ram, Lakshman, Hanuman? Okay. Well, hundreds and hundreds of people do. This is one of the Diwali celebrations at the governor's mansion. They sponsored an entirely vegetarian dinner on each and every one of those occasions. We would do the Lakshmi Puja, the Lakshmi worship. And here I'm giving a copy of the Ramayana to the governor and also another one to Scott Anderson, the CEO of Zion's Bank, who is a great lover of Indian culture. In fact, the first Diwali we had in the governor's mansion, Huntsman wasn't there. We had it in the lobby. Later on, we moved upstairs and made a whole dinner of it. But we had in the lobby the Indian ambassador. There was a few people there. Now, there's an Indian sweet. You'll see it today. It's round, and it's brown, and it's called a gulab jamun. Gulab means rose. So this is a sweet. It's made from milk powder. And then it's fried and it's soaked in sweet water, flavored with rose water. So it's called a gulab jamun, and it's a little brown sweet, and it literally drips with sweetness and sugar water. So The first words when I first met Governor Huntsman and he came to the temple, his first words were, "I make my own galubjiments." Now, those aren't the first words you expect to come out of a governor's mouth, but trust me, that's what he said. So anyway, he says, "I make my own galubjiments." So we have the first Diwali, and we're there in the lobby, and we're ready to start. Where's the governor? He's nowhere. Where's the governor, you know? And they look all over the governor. Where is the governor? Where is the governor? They finally found him in the kitchen with his jacket off and his sleeves rolled, making the galubjiments. So be sure you get some galubjiments today if you can. Now, this comes to this. I think the chant is going to come in here pretty soon. So let me give you a quick explanation of what follows here. Can you all still hear me okay? Can you hear okay in the back? Okay. This is a miniature version of what in many temples is a much larger hill. The incidences of the Ramayana happened many tens of thousands of years ago. This incident happened about 5,000 years ago during the pastimes of Lord Krishna. We believe, just as a Christian believes, that Lord Jesus Christ came to the planet 2,000 years ago. He's on the planet for about 32 years. We also believe that the Lord Himself, the Supreme Lord of all, He descended 5,200 years ago. He was on the planet for 125 years. In the seventh year of His manifest pastimes, the king of rain, Indra, decided to test the powers of baby Krishna, who at that time was manifesting the pastimes of a seven-year-old boy. So he called devastating rain clouds and told them to cover the rural village where Krishna appeared, our version of Bethlehem, in floods and floods and floods and floods of water. He said, make it so that unless Krishna does something extraordinary, all the cows and all the people will drown. So the storm began and it continued. The water came down like columns, like pillars. And everyone was in great distress and the water was rising and they were in danger. So they called out, "Krishna, Krishna, please save us." Whenever we chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, we're recognizing that life is very precarious in this material world. None of us are guaranteed 50 years of life, or 40 years of life, or 10 years of life. None of us are even guaranteed another day of life. It's very precarious. And thus, this material world is called samsara, forest fire. We're living in like a forest fire, and we could go at any moment. And so we are always basically trying to keep the name of Krishna on our tongue. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. Krishna, please save us from this forest fire, birth, death, disease, and old age. We would like to live in that world which is eternal. When we go out to the lake and we light our lamps and we float them, I'm going to give you the benediction that's a common benediction in India, and I won't say it now, but basically the sum of it is that may you get out of this material world. I will not benedict you to have more anchors and more attachments in this material world. I will not benedict you to be attached and live a life of comfort, and then because of those attachments and that karma, have to come back again, birth after birth after birth. If you really want to wish someone well, you will not benedict them to have more comforts. Because the purpose of life is not to accrue comforts. The purpose of life is to build character. And often we build character more through discomfort than we do comfort. So, in this way, the inhabitants of Vrindavan, recognizing the precariousness of their situation, they called out, "Krishna, please save us." And intelligent people who also realize that we're also always in a precarious position, they always try to make it a regular daily habit of chanting the various mantras glorifying the Lord. So in any case, Krishna responded to their calls of distress in a totally unique way. You see not only this painting, but it also matches with this one in the wall. He lifted the nearby mountain called Govardhan Hill with the little finger of his left hand, and he detached it from the earth. He scooped it up as easily as a child scoops up a mushroom, and he held it aloof on the little finger of his left hand. While holding this mountain up in the air, he called all the cows and all the inhabitants, "Please come and take shelter from the rain and the wind and the ice under this umbrella of the mountain where everything will be warm and dry." And this went on for 7 days until Indra, the king of rain, had totally exhausted himself and realized that he had offended a power much greater than his. At that time, Indra came down riding on his elephant. You see the elephant there? That is Aryavata. And incidentally, he was also one of the creatures that was generated when the ocean of milk was churned. That was Aryavata. And Aryavata went to Indra. So Indra came down, and both Indra and the elephant bowed down and asked Krishna's pardon for their impertinence. Now, today, thousands of pilgrims, they circumambulate this hill. They walk around it and accrue piety by doing so. It's a 25-kilometer walk. Takes about 4 miles. Now, one station on this circumambulation is this ghat or lake here, and it's called Aryavata Ghat. Again, Aryavata is the name of the elephant. And this man here is pointing out two oblong depressions in two big rocks there. And that is said to be where the elephant kneeled down and offered his obeisances to Lord Krishna. And after getting up, he sprayed the Lord with a fine shower of rose water by way of making his apologies. This is the temple of Govardhan on top of the hill. And this is the town of Govardhan. Go is a Hindi and Sanskrit word which means cows. One of the things that the Lord did when he appeared and descended was during his childhood pastime, he personally took charge of herding the calves in his village. We understand from this that the Lord is very fond of cows. One of the most often repeated prayers in praise of the Lord, Namo Brahmanya Devaya, Go Brahmanya Hitaya Cha, Jigat Hitaya Krishnaya, Govindaya Namo Namaha. The Lord Krishna, He's the well-wisher of all living beings. He wants the best for all creatures. He wants human beings, He wants governments, He wants states, He wants constituencies to be happy and prosperous and peaceful. So, He wants that the cow be protected. And he says, in a culture, in a society, when the cow is protected and not harassed and terrified and killed, then the people will also be happy. And where the cow is victimized and exploited, the people themselves will also be full of anxiety and worry and disquietude. One poet, he said, and I think they must be coming here pretty soon, so I'm going to wind this up. One poet, he said, we shape ourselves the joys and fear of which the coming life is made and fill our future's atmosphere with sunshine or with shade. So I ask this question, do you think the future atmosphere of a country that kills 1 billion animals a year is going to be an atmosphere of sunshine or shade? Got it? All right. Some people, that's fine. I'm happy with that. Good, like that. So this is where the Lord herded the cows in Vrindavan. And this is the temple in Vrindavan after which this temple is modeled. This is called Kusham Sarovar, or Temple in a Lake of Flowers, in that area. And that was the inspiration for this temple here. This is the Parakram path going around Vrindavan. As I said, if you walk around Govardhan Hill today, you're considered to be burning up your sins or limiting your karma. And most people can do it in about 5 hours. Now, here's an option. See this man here? He is doing what's called Dandavat Parakram. He is traversing those 25 kilometers by prostrating himself flat on the ground. He has a little stone. And when he lays out like a stick, danda, danda means stick. So when you do dandavat, you prostrate yourself straight out with your arm. And he puts that stone at the furthest extension of his fingertip. Then he gets up, he advances himself by that distance, he picks up the stone, and then he prostrates himself. And in this way, he goes around Govardhan Hill. I had a man visit me from North Carolina a couple years ago, Vikram Seth. And he's a big executive at IBM. He's been with IBM for about 15 years. And he earns a six-figure salary. And we were looking at this picture, and he was saying, you know, I did the Govardhan Parikram. And I said, so you walked, you took it half a day and you walked around? He said, no, I actually did the Dandavat Parikram. And I said, I've always been curious. How long did that take you? He said, 3 weeks. 3 weeks. Like that. But imagine if coming to the temple, you get a little red dot on your forehead as symbolic of the dust on which the Lord walked. If you went to Bethlehem and you picked up some dust, there's a good chance that 2,000 years ago, one of those particles of dust touched the feet of Lord Jesus Christ. See? So if you're a Vaishnava or a devotee of Krishna and you go to Vrindavan, you worship the dust because the Lord's feet walked on that dust, you see? So if you can have your body in contact with that dust for 3 weeks, there's nothing more auspicious. So this is a guy, you know, he's got all material prosperity and success with IBM, but he's taking the dust, he's taking the bath for 3 weeks of the dust of the lotus feet of the Lord. Even this holy place is so holy that the dogs and the hogs are going to be, they consider they're going to get salvation in the next life because they're always in touch with the dust, the holy dust of Vrindavan. So let's see what else we've got here. This is the founder of our international society putting on Tilak in Vrindavan. Here is our Govardhan. This is the Govardhan in Chopati in the Bombay. This is the one 1008. I'm sorry that we don't come up to that standard. I mean, after all, this is not Bombay. This is not India. This is Utah. This is Spanish Fork. We do okay, right? We do okay. Got it? Good, good. But if next year we come to Bali, you all cook something in your home that doesn't have eggs or meat or fish, and you bring it, maybe we can get up to 108 next year. We can try that, okay? So try that. Bring a little something next year. But this is by Pragna. Pragna is here. You want to come up here? And so the chanting party, what's taking him so long? Okay. All right. Well, I think I should sort of wind up this presentation. We've been going for about 40 minutes. And hopefully I have answered the question, you know, all the things that you wanted to know about Diwali, but didn't know who to ask. Here is Kiran here. Kiran, why don't you stand up? This is Kiran Kamdar. And when we used to borrow the neighbor's cows for this celebration. Later on, we'll have the Go Puja in this pavilion because we don't want to stress them by bringing them up in the elevator. But we used to borrow cows for this. And it always made us feel bad because we knew that sooner or later, those cows would be slaughtered. I mean, how many cows in our culture die of old age? Like two, you know? And so we wanted our own cows, and we wanted purebred Indian cows. Same time, we didn't want full-size cows because we didn't, you know, want to make that commitment. So we talked about getting 3 purebred Zebu cows, and Kiran made that possible for us. She donated the funds not only to acquire Nandi, our bull, and our 2 cows, Gauri and Gita, but also to house them in a nice little shed with insulation and a heat lamp during the winter. So I don't know about you, but I'm going to express my appreciation to Kiran. Okay. All right. Seeing as how the kirtan's late, we actually might be able to finish this. The folk dancing, which we're going to do at the end in the pavilion, it's very, very popular in Rajasthan. And when you get 100 or 200 people with those sticks going clackety, clack, clack, it raises your hackles. It's soul-stirring. This is the same type of folk dancing done on Diwali in Rajasthan. And here is a champion. This Vashanti is a champion. If you have never seen her moves, you haven't lived. She is going to be putting the moves in the pavilion. She is fantastic. And here is a little girl just starting out. This is, we used to do the Dandiyan here, but we outgrew it. So now we go to the pavilion, which is a much bigger area. And these are the deities of Sri Sri Radha and Krishna. And we wish you, it's traditional on this day, whenever you meet someone and you want to wish them well, you say, Happy Diwali. So can you say with me, Happy Diwali!